Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all the men and women who have served and to those who are serving in the United States Air Force.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And good morning, all of you. Good morning, From Ann Arbor, Michigan, this is Bob Gould, broadcasting from WDEOAM right there. And also those of you that are listening on the Internet, www.veteransradio.net. Welcome, welcome, and also to the new year. There she is. I know. Maybe new glasses, new hairdo. She's got her gotchkes on. She doesn't know what that is. All those that know what that is, raise your hands. Yeah, that's your long underwear, because, folks, it's going down to -2 tonight. Ooh, that makes you more appreciative of some of the things that went on with a lot of our American soldiers over there in Korea and in Europe and wherever else that they fought. It was cold. Nina, hello.
Hello, Bob. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Good. I should hope so.
Did you have a nice holiday?
I did. Me and my family, we got our grandmother home from the hospital. So
oh, that's good.
We're very
yeah.
glad to have her back for the holiday.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I just want to say hello to my family.
And we want to say wish a more speedy recovery for your grandma from all of us here at Veterans Radio. And which reminds me, folks, we really don't have a whole lot of announcements. We'll get right to our feature in just a moment, but I do have a couple things. By the way, if you have something, anything, anywhere, hey, man, I live in Washington, what about me? Yes, let us know, and we'll be glad to put that on over the air. So more things are going to be coming up very shortly in the first of the year. I think everybody's still recovering from the holiday. But I did get a couple of emails. Somebody wanted to know about suits for soldiers. So how do you know about suits for soldiers? You go www.suitsforsoldiers.org. Suitsforsoldiers.org. It's a wonderful organization. Find out more about it. And the e-benefits. You want to go to e-benefits, that's like Echo, benefits.va.gov. e-benefits.va.gov. We got a number of requests for these websites where you can get this information on benefits. Get everything you have that you deserve. You work for it. It was in the contract. And now go ahead and use it. Okay. Well, and looking right now, we're going to get right onto our main feature in just a second. Right after, oh, yes, it is all about China. I'm going to welcome Dr. Rebecca Grant, a frequent guest here on Veterans Radio. So we'll be right back after this important message. Don't go away.
You're listening to Veterans Radio live from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or listen online at AveMariaRadio.net.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Atlanta boys getting the gun. The Air Force salute is the Air Force song, and that is our prelude to welcoming a frequent guest right here on Veterans Radio, Dr. Rebecca Grant, president of IRIS Independent Research. It's a public policy research organization located right in the central part of government, Washington, D.C. She's also director of the Washington Security Forum. Oh, that sounds like an interesting organization. See, Dr. Grant was also a member of the Secretary of the Air Force Staff Group and of the Air Force Chief of Staff's Operation Group, CCX. Dr. Grant is an active member of the Air Force Association. She writes regularly for Air Force Magazine and served from 2008 and 2011 as the founding director of the Mitchell Institute. Whew. Well, give us a big hand right now and a welcome to Dr. Grant. Dr. Rebecca Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to be back on the radio with you again.
Here we are. What? 2014. Here is one, if not the largest country in the world. And back not too many years ago, we allied with them, and then we called them the enemy after World War II, and then we became the great Satan. But then Korea came along and they intervened, and all of a sudden now they became a trading partner. They're our largest debitor. Ford, General Motors wants to sell cars to these people. And we're talking about China and what's going on. They're saber-rattling. They're expanding their territory. What's going on here?
Well, you're right, Bob. We certainly did hear the rattling of sabers in the Pacific, especially last month in December and in November as well. I find it amazing, like you, that we are here talking about China as a potential military competitor and even, I think now, maybe as a real adversary. So let's look at some of the things that have changed in the last couple of months. The big news began in November when China declared an ADIZ. Do you know what an ADIZ is, Bob?
Yes, an air defense zone.
That's right.
Information zone. No. Go ahead.
We'll give you a 3 out of 4 on ADIZ. I had to look it up myself. It's an air defense identification zone.
And by the way, tell the folks that we were the first ones to have an ADIZ right after World War II. Is that right?
I think that's right, to have the ADIZ there. And now an ADIZ is a fairly standard feature of global air operations. What's different is that China declared this ADIZ in Japanese airspace. So that was a problem. they really have asserted some sovereignty here, but you have to kind of peel back the layers as to what exactly this means. And I think it's interesting in a way that, you know, we hear a lot about China with our obviously big trading partner for us. But these bits of news about China's military just pop up every so often. And this one is really, I think, shook us up a bit, and for good reason. So on November 23rd, China declared that there would now be an ADIZ in this kind of small portion of the East China Sea. And I don't know about you, Bob, but I have to pretty much pull out my map every time I'm looking at this region, because it's not the one that we're very familiar with, but this is very close to both Japan and Taiwan. And the key feature here is this airspace is right over top of some disputed islands. The Japanese, who have claimed the sovereignty of these islands for some time, call them the Senkakus, and China likes to call them the Diaoyus, naturally two different names. Island is a stretch for these pieces of rock, basically, that sit there out in the East China Sea. They're really very, very small, but they have become a huge flashpoint as China attempts to assert its stature and to have other countries treat it as a major power in the region. So we've known for really for about 2 years there's been quite a bit of diplomatic sparring between China and Japan over these islands. There have been some encounters between Japanese aircraft and Chinese aircraft, also between Chinese Navy ships and the Japanese as well. So China, in the November 23rd move, they really took things to the next level. So not only now is China claiming sovereignty over these islands on the surface, when they declare the Aegis, they're trying to claim sovereignty over the airspace as well. So that's a step up the ladder. That's a military step. That's, in a way, an escalation of the tensions. And that's why the Aegis announcement was so important.
Now, we have, because of World War II, we have pledged, and we do protect Japan. We do. It's a trading partner, and we do protect them. So here we are caught, folks. We have China, and we have Japan. We have our treaties with Japan, and we're going to protect them. We're going to provide the military might so that Japan doesn't have. But now we have China, and the last time that you were on the program, Dr. Grant, you talked about that China has stealth technology. Now, that stealth, if I'm not mistaken, was used for fighters and not for bombers, and I make a distinction. Is that true?
That's right. China right now is developing. They have two prototype stealth aircraft, also a couple of stealthy unmanned vehicles, it looks like. And there have been rumblings about whether they might attempt to build a stealth bomber. I think what we can take from that is they're certainly pursuing the advanced technologies. We've seen their stealth fighters fly, and that is one of the parts of their policy, which is to assert a more aggressive military stance. Now, they call it defensive, but their version of defensive happens to extend a pretty long way beyond their shores and through the Pacific as well.
Now, this whole thing about Aegis, could it be, because economic factors are between China and Japan, they're still trading. Figure that one out, folks. Here they are, pointing fingers at each other, throwing snowballs, and they're still trading. In fact, after all the bluff and bluster, from what I've been reading, they're almost back to the same levels that they were before all this started just a few months ago. Is that true, Dr. Grant?
Yeah, I expect that is true. But, you know, the Cold War, in a way, gave us a different perspective. We didn't trade much with the Soviet Union in the Cold War. But let's remember, Britain and Germany and France all traded heavily right up until the beginning of World War I. So trade relations are not an indicator that all is well, necessarily. I think trade will continue. What we've really seen is, of course, strong trading relationships between China and really the entire globe, certainly its region, certainly us. But there is still a level of conflict. Slowed the conflict. It's not like you can have trade and not this other territorial sparring. I think, Bob, World War II is very relevant to what's going on today. If we can just go back for a minute, we, of course, came into World War II on December 7th, 1941, or declaration of war on the 8th, I believe. But long before that, Japan had invaded China. And there was a terrible fighting there for years, and the Chinese remember this very clearly. Japan dominated.
Well, they were massacred.
The massacres, terrible things that went on, and none of this has been forgotten in China. I think it's hard for us so far away to understand the illogical and kind of knee-jerk reaction that China has. I think you could say that, in a way, China still thinks Japan is capable of being a threat. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but this is an emotional reaction on the part of China.
Now, are there natural resources like gas, oil, etc., that are near the ADIZ and the islands? Are those reserves there?
Right. China is dependent on natural resources, and especially on oil imports, and there are oil prospects in this area of the East China Sea, as well as a bit further south in the South China Sea, which I want to talk about a little bit later in the program. But I think what we're really seeing here is partly a contest for future resources, but also a playing out of some old diplomatic issues as China looks for its place in the world order, and it's looking for a much bigger place. So the conflict over the islands and the Aegis really is a China-Japan conflict. It's important to us because, as you said, Japan is our ally. So scrolling back again for a moment to the World War II time frame, the Allies are victorious, and part of the agreement is that Japan will not use military force as part of its foreign policy. Part of the agreement also is that the U.S. and allies will help to defend Japan if that ever becomes necessary. And that doesn't come up for years. China, after the 1949 revolution, largely turned inward. There, of course, were the forays into Korea, some border incidents with Vietnam as well. But then for the last many decades, China really has been an inward power. All that changed in the 90s and particularly in the 2000s, and we now see China as much more forward-leaning. It's developed its military forces tremendously over the past 10 years. So imagine that you are Japan, looking at what is now a rising military power right next door in China, and one that is very suspicious of anything that Japan does. So here is the rub of the issue with the Aegis. It's a China-Japan territory dispute over territory that in itself, these rocky little islands are really worthless, but they symbolize the changing balance of power in the region, and they are providing an avenue for China to flex its military muscles. That's why it's so worrying.
Well, Vice President Biden has been there, and he's trying to soothe things over. Are we going to have any effect at all to bring these sides to the table for some negotiation? What do you think about that?
Well, this is the question with China and why I think China is so very different. There have been a number of high-level trips. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, visited China earlier in the year. Of course, President Obama has had several meetings with the new Chinese Premier Xi Jinping. So we just are going to have to get used to several layers in this relationship. There will be trade. There will be high-level diplomatic contacts. And apparently, there also will be ongoing military confrontation. I predict that this will be the pattern for the next several years. We will continue to see open dialogue and exchanges, but that we will also see China continuing to push the limits. And what's really so different about the last couple of months is this is not a policy statement where they say, oh, you know, we're looking for a greater role. This is real use of military units, and here is where you really see the change, and you get, of course, a potential for things to get out of control and for accidental escalation. Here's, you know, the specifics about the AIDS, Air Defense Identification Zone, are highly relevant. So before November 23rd, this was airspace that fell to Japan, but my understanding is if you were, let's say, a military aircraft flying in that area, the Japanese would probably track you, but basically it was open to anyone. What China has said is they want to make this AIDS a much more formal area where you have to have a reason to go into this airspace over these islands. And technically, there are many, many other AIDS around the world. We have them here. We have quite an AIDS over Washington, D.C., believe me. And to fly through an AIDS, you have to file a flight plan in advance, and carry communications equipment on the aircraft, a transponder of some sort that would allow you as the aircraft to communicate with whoever is in charge of the ADIS. So China says that's them. They're in charge of this ADIS. If you want to fly over these islands, then you have to inform us in advance and talk to us the whole time as we track you through here.
If you have a question for our guests, folks, please call us at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. You're listening to Veterans Radio with Dr. Rebecca Grant, speaking about China, Japan, the whole Far Eastern. Dr. Grant, continue, please.
So with China's ADIS, what China has said is if you want to fly over these disputed islands, you have to file a flight plan, let us know in advance, and we'll track you the whole way. This is a big change. It's like if you own a piece of land, and that's been, you know, common land for a long time, and someone pops up one morning and says, oh, you want to walk over here? You have to tell me in advance. And it's relevant because it's a big change, and it's a military step. The question to my mind is, what happens next? If we don't challenge this zone and a year or two goes by, does China say, well, you know, you accepted this, and now we want to extend the ADIS? Of course, there was a challenge of sorts almost immediately. Two B-52s, American B-52s, flew from Guam on what they call a tropic lightning mission, and they flew through the air defense zone with no challenge from China. But I think the question going forward is what to do now. Do you continue to send U.S. military aircraft there, Japanese air self-defense force aircraft through that? Do we now have to commit forces to keep that ADIS open for military aircraft traffic? It's really a quandary. You know, the White House initially said they really were strongly condemned what had been done, and White House spokesman Josh Earnest said that China's step was unnecessarily inflammatory and would have a destabilizing impact on the region. True, but question is, what do we do now in terms of our military policy and our military operations there?
Well, we've got a few more minutes before we go on our halftime break. Things are really running fast here, folks. By the way, if you have a question or a comment, please call us at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. You listen to Veterans Radio right here in Ave Maria Radio. Now, right on December 5th, 2013, there was an encounter between the Cowpens, a Navy cruiser, U.S. Navy cruiser, and China's aircraft carrier. Wow, tell us about that.
I know, this is an exciting one. I follow the English language press about China a bit, and usually when you read about one of these things, it's a Japanese vessel and a Chinese aircraft or vessel that are getting a little close to each other. But this time, it was big United States Navy with big People's Liberation Army Navy, PLAN. So their new aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, was on maneuvers, this time down in the South China Sea. So we're talking south of Taiwan, a little bit of a different area from the ADIS, which is over the East China Sea. And it's not uncommon for our U.S. Navy vessels to encounter the Chinese Navy somewhere along that long, long coast. And in fact, you know, they're sort of the law of the sea, and sailors, they know what to do, and it's not uncommon to see them, you know, maybe signal over and say, well, let's practice some basic maneuvers together, you know, we'll all turn left at the same time. So certainly our Navy and the Chinese Navy are no strangers. But what was unusual about this is that apparently there was another ship accompanying the Liaoning, the China's carrier, and it got so close to our guided missile destroyer, guided missile cruiser here, the Cowpens, that everybody had to come to a dead halt. And then the story continues, very interesting. Evidently, the captain of the Chinese aircraft carrier initiated a conversation with the captain of our U.S. Navy cruiser, and they had a discussion, and everything was sorted out. Now, why is this interesting to me? Well, I want to tell you a little bit about who this Chinese captain is. He is one of the bright lights of the PLA Navy. He's a youngish man in his mid-40s. His name is Zhang Zheng, and he speaks English. He learned English when he studied in England at the Royal United Services College for several years. So this is a very sophisticated future leader of China, really smart fellow, terrific Navy career in charge of China's premier ship. So when he called up the captain of our cruiser, they talked in English and sorted the situation out. The good news is that nobody scraped paint, as they say in the Navy, no holes hit one another. But the bad news is that all this came way, way, way too close. And this is really quite a different incident than anything we've seen before.
Well, I think that we can look at the ADIZ, and if we don't do something about it, that these confrontations, if it's just left to be, folks, that there are risks, and the risk could be a simple accident, just like we were just talking about, a collision, miscalculation, or there could be a gambit by the PLA to extend its regional influence, or is this a sign of things to come from China, or are we also going to get pulled into something like Vietnam? I'm thinking all of these. Can you sort some of this out, Dr. Grant?
Right. I think all of those are possible, Bob. And the bottom line to me is China is ready to rumble. They are willing to get a lot closer to our ships and aircraft than we've seen in the past. And that comes from the overall step up in their training, which maybe we can talk a little bit more about later in the program. But they're certainly doing more both with their aircraft and their ships. And the USS Kalpins was there for a reason. It's we have ships that stay out there, as does Japan, providing a missile defense picket line, primarily against North Korea, but also against anything that might come from China. So it's quite normal to have cruisers like this out in the Westpac. They've been there for many years. We expect lots of them to rotate through. What's new is the much, much closer encounters. If you look at the photos of this incident, these vessels are only a few hundred yards apart. And that, to me, is just a little bit scary.
Oh, you don't exactly stomp on the brakes with an aircraft carrier, folks. I mean, it takes about 10 miles to stop one of these things. You're listening to Veterans Radio. If you have a comment for our guest or a question, please call us at 877-573-7825. And, Nina, I think this is time to let Dr. Grant have a sip of coffee, tea, whatever, and we can take our break. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO AM Ave Maria Radio. Nina.
You're listening to Veterans Radio Live on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, and online at AveMariaRadio.net.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Sergeant David Bleek, although a medical aid man, killed 3 North Korean soldiers and disarmed 2 more. Details after this.
I am a United States sailor.
I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America, and I will obey the orders of those appointed over me.
I represent the fighting spirit of the Navy and those who have gone before me to defend freedom and democracy around the world.
I proudly serve my country's Navy combat team with honor, courage, and commitment. I am committed to excellence and the fair treatment of all.
I am a United States sailor.
Bleek volunteered to accompany a reconnaissance patrol committed to engage the enemy and capture a prisoner for interrogation. Forging up the rugged slope of the key terrain, the group was subjected to intense automatic weapons and small arms fire and suffered several casualties. After administering to the wounded, Bleek continued to advance with the patrol. Nearing the crest of the hill while attempting to cross the fire-swept area to attend the wounded, he came under hostile fire from a small group of the enemy concealed in a trench.
entering the trench. He closed with the enemy, killed two with his bare hands, and a third with his trench knife. Moving from the emplacement, Bleek saw a concussion grenade fall in front of a companion and, quickly shifting his position, shielded the man from the impact of the blast. Later, while ministering to the wounded, a hostile bullet struck him, but, despite the wound, Bleek undertook to evacuate the wounded comrade. As he moved down the hill with his heavy burden, two enemy soldiers with fixed bayonets attacked him. Closing with the aggressors, he grabbed them and smacked their heads together, then carried his helpless comrade down the hill to safety.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Could be a B-52 or whatever else you want it to be. And with us right now on Veterans Radio today on the first program of 2014, Dr. Rebecca Grant, president of IRIS Independent Research, a public policy research organization located in Washington, D.C. And we're currently talking about China, Japan, the U.S., all this that is going on. Oh, boy. Exciting stuff. And then on the other hand, it's a little concerning. So if you have a question or a comment, please call us at 877-573-7825. Dr. Grant, okay, second half, we're talking about China. They have a new president, Xi Jinping. Oh, boy, and he's got a pop star wife and daughters. And tell us all about that.
Oh, he is such an interesting man, Bob. I'm glad you brought him up. And I don't know, I wouldn't recognize a single Chinese character. I tell you, actually, no, I know about two or three. Anyway, I think they pronounce his name Xi Jinping. He became basically president of China. He has several other titles, the most important of which is General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, which is, the one party that controls the state. And he's been a career politician. Very interesting man, though. There's a lot about him that's different, and I think it's worth talking about for a little bit because I do think we, as Americans, need to have a better understanding of China. It's not, I never studied China much in school, and I think it's really taken us a lot of time to catch up with China and who they are. So a little bit about Xi Jinping.
Is he a Maoist?
He is. His father, well, you know, they all are. So, I mean, you know, Mao is still, still very much, the Communist Party still very much controls China, despite the fact that they're terrific traders and have a tremendous heritage. So Xi Jinping is what some people call a princeling. And that means that his father was one of Mao's revolutionaries in the war, of course, that ended up with the victory of Mao in 49. And that's always been a group whose children were highly favored. What's interesting, though, about Xi Jinping is that his father fell out of favor and was actually purged by Mao when Xi Jinping was a young teenager. It ended up with him being sent out to the provinces, and in the end, after the death of Mao, et cetera, his family was rehabilitated. But by this time, Xi Jinping himself had shown a lot of talent. He's a bright man, a chemical engineer, and he spent some time working for the Central Military Committee as a young man. And observers say that means that although he did not himself spend time in the army, he is pretty familiar with how the military works and, very important, not intimidated by it. So somewhere along the line, he met a woman who was much more famous than she himself. And this is his wife. Her name is Peng Liyuan. You know, in China, you don't take your husband's name when you get married, so she kept her name. She was a beautiful young woman in the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, and she was a singer. I think the best way to think about her and how famous she is in China is she's a little bit of a cross between Celine Dion and Faith Hill. She's got a beautiful voice, but is also known a little bit as a folk singer. So when they met, you know, she was nobody, okay? She was just a young man. But he fell in love with her instantly and won her as his wife, and they've been married quite a long time. With his rise recently in politics has he become known at all. She is very, very famous in China, and she's a beautiful woman. They have a daughter. You know, China has the one-child policy, so they have just one daughter who is in her early 20s and has spent at least a little time enrolled at Harvard as a student under a different name.
Are we looking at Evita? Are we looking at Evita here?
No. She's really just a singer.
But, so she's not influencing her husband.
No, I don't think necessarily. I think what's so interesting is it shows how modern and urban and different Xi Jinping is from the people who have run China in the past. Who tended to be very strict and conservative. This guy really has a lot going for him, a lot on the ball. But here's the real question. There's just not much that intimidates him. Here he was nobody, and he went and courted and won one of China's most famous women. So this man has a lot of self-confidence, I would say. And I think in a way that could translate to what we see in China's policy. Reputedly, he is not intimidated by the conservative generals who run the People's Liberation Army, which is still a very important force in Chinese politics. Unlike here, the fact that Mao won power through military conquest has meant that China's armed forces retain a lot of political influence. They also run a lot of businesses, which is, again, very, very different from our experience. So the fact that Xi Jinping is not intimidated by the old guard, I think, is very relevant to what we'll see from him in the future. I also think it means a little bit that he's very confident. He comes across as very confident in his dealings with President Obama and with other leaders. And I think that we see some of this confidence translating into what he's willing to try with the military. That's why I think it's relevant to look at his background and how really different he is from the previous leaders, even from Hu Jintao, the man that he replaced.
He has so many balls to keep up in the air. He has to keep the development. He has a definitely a huge, I mean, what is there, 2 billion people? I have a friend who travels to China frequently, as in each year. He also teaches Chinese studies down in a university down in Florida. And he said to me, this was years ago, and he said to me, which has really stuck, that if China wanted to, there's people there that want to work, folks. They want to work. They want to start buying Western influence. They want to work. And if we turn that loose, that industrial capacity could really bring the world to its knees. Do you want to comment on that, Dr. Grant?
Oh, you're so right, Bob, about the industrial capacity of China. Forbes magazine tells us that whereas a decade ago there were no billionaires in China, now there are 122 billionaires.
Oh, Mao must be rolling over.
He must be. That's our
billionaires in China?
Billionaires in China, that's right. But, you know, for us, having grown up in the 20th century, we think of China as our World War II ally and then Mao, and a beaten-down country. But, you know, China, for centuries, was a dominant world trading power. At Christmas dinner, when I turned over all those plates to wash, and on the back of them, what do they say? They say, China. Because that's the porcelain, you know, the export that they're so well known for. So what we're seeing, in a way, is a return to how things have been in the past, where China is a major power and a major trading power. And, oh, the power that they are. They do have the U.S. remains the world's largest economy, but China is on track to potentially surpass that. And I think the question, you know, for your veterans radio listeners is, we expect economic growth in China, but do we as Americans also want to let them become a dominant military power in the Pacific? I think not, personally. I don't think that's something we should just let happen. I think that our relations with China, as they grow, will go much more smoothly if we maintain the power to balance them in the Pacific and to deter anything that might develop in the next few years. And that's the point of the spear right now. Will we maintain our power and our presence in the Pacific along with our allies so that we can balance the rise of China?
Well, so we don't get our knickers down, that's for sure, and have another Pearl Harbor. We are staying current on this. But okay, what is the Air Force response? What are they doing right now? Because I want to make one point, at least what I feel. Since China developed a stealth fighter, but if they develop a stealth bomber, that's offensive. Is that true?
Yes, it is. And let's note that China does have a handful of bombers now. And what's so relevant about them, they're actually they're pretty old. They've been upgraded, both with engines and different avionics. But they are a variant of an old Soviet bomber. They're pretty ugly looking. But they carry under their wings a type of cruise missile that has a pretty long range. And even now, theoretically, it can target Guam. And if these aircraft want to fly out and do a show of force, they're becoming capable of doing that. Let's talk for a minute about China's Air Force. It's called the People's Liberation Army Air Force. And it is not the leading light of China's military. Most of the top jobs are controlled by the army generals. But the PLAAF, or sometimes we call it the PLAF, has made some real strides in recent years, not only in developing new aircraft types, but in expanding their training. It used to be that the Chinese only liked to fly in nice daylight conditions, what my brother the pilot would call VFR, visual flight rules. Maybe you remember that name, Bob, visual flight rules. But in the last few years, since about 2009, the China watchers have noticed that China's Air Force, the PLAF, is doing much more night training, training with dissimilar aircraft types. So one type of MiG will fly with another type, and they'll learn all that. They're starting to take the steps to make them a much more potent Air Force. And they're a big Air Force. They have lots of jets, some that are very old, but by my count, they probably have at least 400 that are good frontline jets, and about another 1,500 back of that.
And what about their drone program?
Oh, they have an active drone program, both in the smaller surveillance drones that work at lower altitudes, and we see signs that they're trying to develop the larger high-altitude, long-range, remotely piloted aircraft, similar to our Global Hawks and our Reapers and the predecessor, the Predator. There's no question that China would like to develop some longer-range surveillance unmanned aircraft. We've seen a few of their experimental types roll out, and I think we'll probably see many, many more. That's going to give them an ability right now that only we have, and that is the ability to conduct steady surveillance of the Pacific. So that means that they are looking to develop the capability to go out and watch our naval and air forces in the Pacific and know what we're doing at all times. That might make us a little bit uncomfortable.
You're listening to Dr. Rebecca Grant, president of IRIS, a research policy organization for the Air Force, and she is a spokesperson for the Air Force. We're right here on Ave Maria Radio, and we'll be right back after this very important message.
You're listening to Veterans Radio live from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or listen online at AveMariaRadio.net.
Ian Ralston was a combat medic who suffered a catastrophic war injury in Iraq. When I met Ian for the first time, I knew we had to do everything we could to get him every benefit he's earned to live as normal life as possible. And we did. He needed an accessible house. We got that grant.
and a van for his wheelchair to get him there. My name is Jason Stevenson, and I work for Paralyzed Veterans of America.
America's most seriously injured veterans are getting all the care and benefits they've earned, thanks to Paralyzed Veterans of America. For over 65 years, Paralyzed Veterans of America has helped hundreds of thousands of veterans, and their service is free to all veterans and their families. Paralyzed Veterans of America, changing lives, building futures. To learn more, visit pva.org. A public service message from Paralyzed Veterans of America.
We're back on Veterans Radio. If you have a question for our guest or a comment, please call us at 877-573-7825. Before we left on the break, we were talking about China and its defense, drones, aircraft. Now we can talk about, and I believe that they're about to, I think, put a person on the moon, or that's going to be, or that is a goal right now for them. So space and cyberspace is coming into all this. What is the Air Force response on that, Dr. Grant?
Well, the Air Force, along with other services, are really taking note of what's going on. Of course, the U.S. Air Force is responsible for our space capabilities, our military space capabilities, and they're the biggest problem China's caused recently came a few years ago when they blew up one of their own satellites on orbit. And this was a problem because they shattered it into about a million pieces. I don't know if you've seen the movie with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney called Gravity, where Sandra Bullock plays an astronaut who is caught up in a incident on orbit where they run into a bunch of space junk, and that sets up the plot of the movie. Well, that's really pretty realistic, because that's what China did by exploding the satellite. It left millions of pieces of junk in orbit. There was some junk up there to start with, but they significantly increased the amount. Some say that China wasn't quite aware of just how angry this was going to make all the other spacefaring nations of the world. So what the Air Force has to do is try to monitor the space junk on orbit. They were doing this to begin with, but this has just made it that much more complicated to do. Also, the Chinese demonstration really proved that China is able to hit anything it wants to in space. Now, while they blew up their own defunct satellite, I don't think anybody missed the overall message, which is that China could blow up your satellite, too, if they felt like it. So several things that the Air Force is doing, monitoring the conditions up in orbit, particularly low Earth orbit, also looking at being able to reposition satellites a little bit more efficiently. There's also research going on into what they call operationally responsive space. That's sort of military speak for being able to launch replacement satellites a little bit more quickly as necessary. And I think the overall point, Bob, is that we're very dependent on space capabilities for our operations in the Pacific for two reasons. Well, three, really. One, of course, is communications. Some of that is least commercial capability, but our military forces really depend on the satellite backbone for communications. We depend on it, of course, for surveillance, and then also for a very specific and important mission called missile warning. There are specialized satellites that detect heat signatures of things like intercontinental ballistic missiles that launch, and they have long made up a very important early warning network to help characterize suspected missile launches from the Pacific and other regions. If China were to in some way try to disrupt any of those space capabilities, then our military forces would be dealing with a level of blindness that is very disturbing. Now, our military forces know that, and they have been thinking hard, I believe, about some workarounds and what to do in the case of denied space capabilities. But it just adds another dimension to the changing balance in the Pacific.
So could we assume that some of the things are going to be that increasing the B-52 presence on Guam?
Yes, we've kept a B-52 and B-2 presence on Guam for, oh, this is 2014. We're coming up on 10 years. There are a couple reasons for this. One, of course, is North Korea, but increasingly the other is China. We maintain a rotation of bombers, a few B-52s or B-2 stealth bombers at a time that go through Guam. They fly regular flights at all points of the compass from Guam. They fly down to Australia. They fly across over to Asia. And as we know from the November flights, they fly north up towards China as well. And that presence is called the continuous bomber presence. It's a bit tough. We don't have very many bombers left anymore, Bob, and it's kind of hard to maintain that presence with the other commitments that they have and the training and all that that goes on. But that is sort of absolutely the tip of the spear for ensuring, one, that China knows that we maintain that power in the Pacific. And then there's another purpose that's, to me, is just as important, and that is reassuring our many allies and partners in the Pacific that the U.S. really is committed to maintaining security and stability in that region.
Well, can we talk a little bit about that? That when you talk about allies, whom besides Japan is our allies in that area?
Yes, our allies are absolutely critical in the Pacific. Japan is right at the top of the list with a highly capable Air Force. They'll be procuring the new F-35 fighter, and that will give them a continued edge. They fly F-15s now. They're a terrific Air Force, also a terrific Navy. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, the U.S. and Japan kind of take rotational duty in forming a missile defense picket line out there in the Western Pacific. They operate some very, very modern ship types, and they're really good. In addition to Japan, another one in the absolute top of the list is Australia. The Royal Australian Air Force, the RAF, are a very, very capable Air Force. They fought beside us in Afghanistan. They have several new aircraft types ranging from the Boeing Super Hornet. They'll also be procuring the F-35. They're just a great, great ally. And they were one of the first to call China's bluff back in the late 2000s and to remind us as Americans that they hoped that we would stick with them. Australia remembers from World War II what it was like when Britain backed out of their Pacific security commitments due to the pressures of war in Europe. And we don't want to see that happen again. Australia has been very, very open. We often fly aircraft there. We've looked at expanding marine training in Australia. And Australia is just critical to anything and everything we do. Bob, interestingly, like us, Australia has a huge trade relationship with China. So they're very, very realistic about what's going on and that need to maintain both trade and defense.
I think there's also, when you mention trade, we want to sell a lot of cars there. We want to sell cars. GM and Ford are making huge, huge investments in 2014 to sell and build cars in China. And I know that that makes the people happy because they can buy more Western-influenced things. And what is... How have the Chinese people reacted to Xi Jinping's this whole saber rattling? And I mean, we have the international community is up in arms and throwing up their hands and waving their arms in the air. But what are the Chinese people? What do they feel?
Well, I think Xi Jinping is still quite popular, and I think there are two main ideas that you see here. And one is that it's perfectly appropriate for China to use and deploy its military forces. After all, they're still pretty close to Chinese territory. So I think there's partly a feeling that, well, what's wrong with this? It's sort of business as usual, the way we want to do things. The other background factor is this continued suspicion of Japan. So I believe that when the average Chinese person looks at this island dispute in the 80s, they aren't so much saying, well, you know, Xi Jinping, he's really sticking it to the Americans. I think they're saying, well, you know, Xi Jinping, he's really telling those Japanese to watch out. So they see just that first layer of the competition. But they believe, and they've made so clear in their policies, that they just want to assert their international standing in their own area. And, you know, some of the China watchers are long-time China experts here have put it pretty clearly. I particularly like Michael Swain from the Carnegie Endowment, and he says, you know, China just wants to make it much more difficult for America and Japan to be confident that they can use military force in the Pacific. And this is exactly what they're trying to do. They may not want to take over the world, but they want the U.S. to stay a little bit further out of their backyard. The thing is, we just don't know where this stops. And it really does immediately tread on the sovereignty of our close allies in the Pacific.
Well, we'll sell them lots of Fords and Chevrolets, that'll be sure, and that'll help all kinds of things. Well, we've got about 3 minutes before we have to say goodbye, and I would think that China is not going to accept anything less than an acknowledgement that a territorial dispute exists. And if it wins, then Beijing will keep trying to chip away at Japan's sovereignty and all the risks that it entails. What do you think about that, Dr. Grant?
Chip away. That is exactly the way to describe what they're doing. And eventually it won't be just Japan, but of course China has a big dispute with the Philippines and others and with Vietnam over other islands further to the south. So it's really a question for us. What do we do as China tries to chip away? That's the hardest thing to face. Do we decide to draw the line now and oppose the ADIZ? Do we wait a few years until there are multiple areas where China has chipped away? Or do we stand back and let them chip away for a decade, only to find that our influence has really shrunk and our allies are much less secure? It's very, very hard to know. It will require some very wily statesmanship on our part and a commitment to see this the way the Chinese do, and that is the long term. How do we want this relationship to play out over the next 10 and 20 and 30 and 50 years? China thinks that way, and it's time for America and our allies to take that long view as well.
I was just watching something on television yesterday, and the great dam that they're building, it seems like they're paving over the past and going into the future. This huge project. I know that you're familiar with this great Chinese dam. It's there to generate a tremendous amount of power, with electrical power, which means economic power, which means more influence in the world. Wow, we're all standing by, or are we not standing by? We have about one more minute. Dr. Grant, are we standing by? What can we do? What is your final thoughts on all this?
I think we're waking up to the complex issue that China presents. You're right about their economic development, and we want to continue to trade with them. It's important for us as well, but it's important that we decide now how we want to balance out this relationship. And frankly, pushing back a little bit with our military is an important part of what we do. We're going to have to do that in order to make sure China doesn't think that they can have everything their way and begin to run roughshod over first our allies and then us and our interests as well. We want to make sure China really becomes a force of stability and not a force of instability in the Pacific. Right now, we're seeing a little too much instability. I say we push back a little bit.
It's like watching two boxers, two heavyweight boxers, two giants fighting it out in the international world. And the international world. Oh, there's our theme coming up. Dr. Grant, I want to thank you very much for giving so much of your time so early in the morning away from your family. But go back and is it snowing there in Washington?
We have snow. It's sledding weather.
Yes, that too. We're expecting a foot tonight. But anyway, folks, thank you, Dr. Grant. This is Bob Gould for Veterans Radio saying for Nina and myself and Dale, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.